This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
These diapers have turned into dirt in 3 months' time. I mean, doesn't that just blow your mind?
Today on Sea Change Radio, we feature two different ways that strategic partnerships can help organizations make better progress toward environmental sustainability. First, we talk with Jem Bendel about some strange bedfellows. More and more, nonprofits and non-governmental organizations are getting together with multinationals in cross-sectoral partnerships. Ostensibly, these partnerships increase the nonprofit sector's capacity for good, and they certainly represent an increasing trend as other revenue streams dry up. But what are the implications, compromises, and repercussions involved when nonprofit entities partner with these unlikely allies? Is this trend the hope for benevolent organizations or a Faustian bargain? Next, we learn about Earthbaby, a Bay Area-based company that's trying to cut into the number three contributor to our country's landfills, disposable diapers. In order to accomplish their mission, this small for-profit company has partnered with a local composting company and an international compostable diaper producer to help Bay Area families with infants and toddlers leave their kids with a cleaner world. My guest on Sea Change Radio is Professor Jem Bendel. He is a professor at IE Business School in Madrid, and he is also the director of LifeWorth Consulting. Jem's new book is called Evolving Partnerships, A Guide to Working with Business for Greater Social Change. We had him on the show last year to discuss the future of luxury, the future of green luxury. Jem, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
And well, thanks for having me back.
So your new book explores cross-sectoral partnerships. In a nutshell, what does that mean?
It means that in the mid-90s, a lot of people who cared about the state of the planet, whether they worried about poverty or deforestation, whatever big issue, they felt governments weren't doing enough and they were fed up waiting for governments to do something. And so they started teaming up themselves in new ways. So you had, at the time, these really unusual relationships between businesses and nonprofits. As for example, the one I ended up, my first job out of university, I went to work for WWF, the environmental group, and I ended up, my first job was working with about 50 companies in the UK, helping them to source their wood from sustainable forests and help to create market demand then for this new organization called the Forest Stewardship Council that was setting standards for what constituted responsible, sustainable forestry. So this is started in the mid-90s, all these new alliances, new collaborations across sectors, meaning so not just businesses working together or not just NGOs working together, that's non-governmental organizations, but working across sectors in normally groups like Greenpeace, WWF, Oxfam. They didn't really work with companies before the mid-90s. Maybe companies would have given them something for a project, but actually working together, that was an unusual thing. So my work has been in that field since the mid-90s when I left university, and this is my third book on the topic, and it's focusing on what the future of these types of partnerships are, recognizing not only that they can really create a lot of change when governments aren't leading, but also they're quite limited in terms of the amount of transformation that they can produce. So actually we need to start thinking about how we can really scale up the impact of these partnerships, and then of course what's the appropriate role for government to actually help scale up these types of initiatives.
So in the early stages of this partnership, how did the two organizations, which come from very different worlds and have different goals, one is to satisfy its stockholders and the other is to whatever the mandate of the non-government organization may be, how do they usually come together? For example, in this one, how did this, was it a corporation that kind of initiated the dance or the other way around?
In this case, it was the same idea developed in both organizations, which is quite interesting because, as you say, they're so different. So you have organizations with yes, very, very different interests. So Unilever, I think at the time, it accounted for 20% of the world's frozen fish market. So they were realizing that the future of the business depended on there being fish in the sea. And there were, you've already seen the collapse of fish stocks in various different parts of the world. And so they really needed, from a commercial point of view, to begin to see solutions to this problem. And WWF, on the other hand, well, its mandate is to promote harmony between people and nature, to conserve the world's biodiversity. And so they were looking for new ways to promote a change on sustainable fishing, because the lobbying of governments over the years was not seeming to achieve enough change. At least that's what the idea was at the time. So there was this alignment. So they've interests, but then an alignment around this public goal. And they could bring different competencies and ideas and resources to the table.
So is this a good thing? For example, if a listener wanted to give money to Oxfam or UNICEF or any other NGO, and they found out that they were partnering with General Motors, or let's even take one that has more of a notorious bent, like a Massey Energy or an Enron from back in the day. Is this a good thing for them, or is this a reason for me to think twice before giving to one of these NGOs?
Well, I think it's good that you're thinking twice and three times before you give money. I think we need to always look and see whether an NGO is being sensible and effective with the money that they get from us. But I wouldn't say that you shouldn't give money to an NGO because they're working with a company, or that you should because they're working with a company. There are good and bad partnerships.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Dr. Jem Bendel. He is a director at LifeWorth Consulting and also a professor at IE Business School in Madrid. Jem, can you tell us about some partnerships that you think have some flaws, these kind of cross-sectoral partnerships combining for-profit companies and non-governmental organizations that haven't really worked so well? We hear about greenwashing, for example.
Yes, it's interesting you mentioned greenwashing. I think many of the critics of these types of collaboration say that they distract us from the harm that many multinational corporations are doing. And so it's not so much what these partnerships can achieve, but what they kind of make us ignore. Now, I share some of that concern, particularly when partnerships are very much just focused on the company giving money to the nonprofit for a project, or maybe doing some cause-related marketing. So, you know, you buy something and a percentage then goes to the charity or to the cause. What we are seeing, though, is that that kind of criticism can often help the partners and challenge the partners to improve and to address some of these concerns. Now, I'll give you one example, because it's probably the most famous one that your listeners will have heard of. And it's in the field of HIV/AIDS, called Product Red. And it was set up initially by the U2 lead singer Bono. And the idea is that you could buy a red Motorola phone, you can buy a red iPhone or iPod, and a red Armani t-shirt, a variety of products which are branded red, and then a percentage of the sale then goes directly to the Global Fund Against AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria for their work on AIDS in Africa. So this is cause-related marketing. The benefit for the companies involved is that they get a lot of free press, editorial coverage, and they get consumer loyalty. And the benefit to the Global Fund and the beneficiaries is that this is a new source of revenue, and these types of new innovative revenues are important given the financial crisis, and it looks like that budgets are being cut by governments for all manner of sort of public goods. So we could just take one example. Motorola Product Red phones. They advertise these phones as designed to fight AIDS in Africa. Yet, inside all our phones, there's coltan from the Congo and other minerals and metals. And mining in Africa is one industry that is directly related to HIV/AIDS infection. you can have responsible mining companies that realize that that's an issue and want to do something about it and try and reduce the risks faced by their workers, try and encourage settlements and build towns around the mines, families can come. And you've got other ones that don't really address this issue and they have higher rates of infection as a result. And so if a company is really going to be doing something against AIDS in Africa, then you would think to be coherent, they would then all look at their supply chain as well and saying, are we buying from responsible mining companies that are actually going to be looking at this issue? And so my hope, though, is that these types of cause-related marketing initiatives will spark those types of debates and then encourage those companies to do more in their supply chain. However, with Product Red, even though these concerns have been raised for many years, we're not seeing, I think, enough commitment within the initiative to actually encourage their corporate partners to change.
More of my discussion with Jem Bendel in a moment on Sea Change Radio.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Dr. Jem Bendel. He is a director at LifeWorth Consulting and also a professor at IE Business School in Madrid. For listeners who may be curious to know some of the products that they've bought or that are in their home right now, what are some of these new eco labels, the new greener products that have come from these cause-related marketing campaigns that are a byproduct of these cross-sectoral partnerships?
This thing is so widespread now. So, I mean, if you go into Starbucks, much of its coffee is Rainforest Alliance certified. So that's a relationship that would have been really unbelievable some years back, that Starbucks, which is often criticized by activists and social and environmental activists, would then be working very closely with an environmental group to certify that its coffee meets basic social environmental standards. And these things are so widespread now. So I think the last assessment was about 11% of the world's timber is certified to the Forest Stewardship Council. So this is just a little idea from, I think, 1993 of a bunch of people who cared about deforestation, working with a few people in DIY or home improvement retail, saying we want to give our consumers a credible guarantee that things are coming from a responsible forest, not a trashed forest. And now it's about 11%. So, I mean, if you go to your local shop, you'll see the Forest Stewardship Council logo on many products today. The problem, though, is that these types of voluntary initiatives can only go so far. And people in these initiatives are motivated to create solutions to these big global problems. And so, you know, 11%, well, that still means that 89% of the world's timber is coming from dubious sources. So the key question of many people involved in these partnerships now is, how can we affect the sector, the industry we're looking at more broadly? And that, for me, is the most exciting part of this agenda, because in the past, a lot of these people came together out of frustration with government, and now there's a discussion about how government can come back into the picture. And I think that parallels a bigger debate in sort of sustainability policy more generally, because it's next year is the 20th anniversary of the Rio Earth Summit, which happened in, I think, June 1992. And back then, the big message from it was the largest summit of all time. All the world's leaders came together and they agreed this idea of sustainable development being that what we must seek sort of an integration of social and environmental concerns. But they called upon non-state actors, both businesses and not-for-profits, to come together to achieve sustainable development. So there was the focus on that, bringing together new actors to create change. Now, in the last 20 years, those actors have come together, and I certainly heeded that call when I left university to try something new, to work in. But what we've learned is not only that we can achieve some change, but it's not actually at the scale or the pace that's needed if we're going to avert, say, the global climate crisis or do something really substantive about the 1 billion people who are hungry today. And so the message I think that we're beginning to hear, and I think which will become very clear at Rio Plus 20 next year, is that all these innovators are now calling governments back to the table and saying, hey, you can do something to help mainstream these innovations. There are examples of, say, governments like in Germany deciding to specify that it wants all forestry in Germany to be certified under the Forest Stewardship Council system. You've got initiatives such as the EU deciding to ban all illegally harvested timber imported into the EU, and they specify FSC as one way of guaranteeing that it's a legal source of timber. So there are various ways now that governments can become back involved and help scale these innovations, and I think that's going to be an interesting agenda going forward.
And I'm curious what kind of conclusions. I haven't read your book yet because it's just coming out this month, and if listeners want to check it out, it's Evolving Partnerships, A Guide to Working with Business for Greater Social Change on Greenleaf Publishing. I'm curious if you think that the cross-sectoral partnerships are a template for going from that 11% to 89% and filling in the gaps, or if it's just a way to kind of kickstart individual organizations, whether they be NGOs or corporations, being able to run on their own and to be able to achieve greater good and larger goals independently.
That's exactly the question that people involved in these partnerships are asking themselves. They're asking, is what they're doing a template for economic governance and for social action going forward? Is this a new form, a new way of working, or are there fundamental limitations? And do we need new types of partnerships to help encourage government back? And I think, in answer to that, what we're seeing is that some partners are looking at how they can use the relationships, these unusual relationships across sector, to create more change. So that EU ban on illegally harvested timber came about in part because of a completely new type of lobbying, which is lobbying by companies and their partner NGO asking for this new law. Previously, we've just seen companies lobbying to get government out of the way, but now we're beginning to see that these leading companies actually would like government to regulate in a way which is in line with their sustainability strategies and investment. So that's one thing. Look at the relationships that you've got and how can you repurpose those to create some bigger change. But I think the second thing that people are asking is maybe we need new types of partnerships that actually are much more systemic, looking at to create greater change right from the start. And that involves asking, what are the core drivers of all these social and environmental problems that we hear so much about and worry so much about and work on? And really, those core problems are problems of economic governance. Why are corporations so free to do what they do? Why is the money system as it is? Why are all these financial pressures on companies to cut corners, externalize costs, and keep the investors happy? And so we're beginning to see some new partnerships focused on those very issues.
Jem Bendel, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Everybody knows I'm stuck on my baby, kissing me dizzy, hugging and loving, sweet on my baby for sure. Tall grass grows, there ain't no maybe. Digging and grooving, moving real slow, sweet on my baby for sure. She loved me all good, rain or shine, just like a diamond in a silver mine. Hello everybody, I'm sweet on my baby. I don't gotta tell, you already know, I'm stuck on my baby for sure.
Our next guest on Sea Change Radio is Karen Nelson,
one of the founders of Earth Baby, which was founded by three Bay Area families who were fed up with the number of disposable diapers being sent to landfills every week. Thanks so much for being with me today.
Thanks for having me.
First, tell us a little bit about Earth Baby, and then we'll talk a little bit more about the overall problem of diaper disposal.
At Earth Baby, our main motive here is to eliminate the number three offender of landfills, which is diapers, from going into the landfill. So it was conceived by one of our founders who had his second baby and realizing after trying to take the garbage out to the garbage can and not being able to fit in yet another bag of diapers, just how much he was impacting our landfill with the amount of diapers just his family was sending there. And being of the engineering mind and creative, he decided, you know, there has got to be a better solution to our current options, which are either plastic disposable diapers. And we know that plastic is this wonderful invention that was made to last forever. And so if you take that and you're sending one of those plastic diapers that a baby wears on their bum for a couple of hours and goes into the landfill forever, you know, conceivably, and that or cloth. So they put their heads together and did a bunch of research and realized that there is such a thing as a compostable diaper. It looks and feels just like a regular disposable diaper, just like a Huggies or a Pampers. But the main difference is that it's plant-based. It's made from a corn-based plastic.
When did diapering seep into our consciousness? Do you know, like, when people became aware of it as one of the big landfill issues?
I think that it's been within the last 10 years that people are really starting to consider the impact that's happened. You know, disposable diapers have not been around all that long.
When did they get introduced?
I believe they started, it was in the 60s.
And before that, everyone did cloth.
Everybody did cloth.
So in terms of composting these diapers, do you do it yourself or do you hire an outside party to do it for you?
So we have a contract with a private commercial composting facility. And so we collect from our customers every week and we take it down to a commercial composting facility. It's actually a really fascinating place. I mean, composting is, of course, the age-old way of dealing with our garbage. And so what goes to that facility is everything from restaurant scraps, green waste, you know, everything you can think of. And so it's a really nice blend of materials to facilitate, you know, the best composting process.
And they have to have a special license, I imagine, to handle human waste?
That's right. They do need to be licensed to deal with human waste.
And where do these Nature Baby Care diapers come from?
So Nature Baby Care was developed by a Swedish mom who had a couple kids in diapers and was also same sort of story, you know, looking for a better option than to what was currently available. And so she is the one who came up with the, you know, whole idea and got it all going a number of years back now. Incidentally, the diapers are made in Israel.
So how do diapers like the Nature Baby Care ones differ in terms of materials from mass market diapers like a Pampers or Huggies?
So the diapers, like I said, are made from a corn-based plastic. And mm-hmm. The corn, by the way, is a non-GMO mm-hmm. corn. The wood pulp in the interior is FSC certified. So, you know, responsibly forested wood pulp. And it's actually a byproduct of the paper industry. You know, so everything that's going into it, none of the materials have been bleached. So you've got all natural materials that are going to just easily break away, you know, degrade when properly composted. Or just like,
I know my wife and I were looking at options when we first had our child, and some of these ones, like seventh generation, they were not compostable. And a lot of these ones, we were looking at them and they sounded great, like chlorine free. I didn't realize that was a major problem. I thought it was a landfill issue.
You know, I think that actually seventh generation, they even color it to make it brown.
Would the diaper itself have the same shelf life in a landfill as
absolutely.
Really?
They're identical. The only difference being that they don't use a bleached material.
And I remember reading these packages and thinking, now, is chlorine-free good because the chemical is then not harming the environment in the production process, or is it because it's not, is chlorine something you want to keep away from your baby's precious little bottom?
Both. Chlorine is leaching into our groundwater from our landfill.
I know it's a little frustrating for somebody who might still be able to buy the Nature Baby Care product, but then can't compost it. Are there any communities that you know that have regular waste disposal that do handle these diapers and can compost them?
You know, for one thing, we're here in the Bay Area. So we happen to be in a community that not only has the consciousness to want to do the right thing, and a lot of people who are really creative and are thinking outside the box, but we also had a composting facility that was licensed to accept human waste. On the Nature Baby packaging, they used to say that they were compostable. They no longer say that on the packaging anymore because in a way they had to take that off so that people weren't tempted to compost them in their own backyards.
Oh, that could be a problem.
So if, you know, we get that question often, well, can I just compost these in my backyard?
Why do I need Earth Baby?
Right. And there's a couple things to that. First and foremost is you're dealing with human waste, possible pathogens and bacterias that you don't want in your backyard. And unless you are a master composter and you know exactly what you're doing and you are regulating and your compost heap and testing it and making sure that it's maintained, you know, that it's, you know, composting gets very hot all in and of itself with the microbes and the bacteria and the fungi doing their work. But unless you know that it's staying above a certain temperature for a certain amount of time, your end soil is not necessarily going to be a sanitary soil. Somebody just throwing it in their backyard heap without, you know, and it's subject to ambient air. So we would never recommend that somebody compost in their backyard.
So if you bought cornstarch bags for your dog, that would not be compostable either, even though it might not last as long in a landfill as a regular plastic bag that you'd get maybe from a grocery store. So it's
but the thing is that actually the situation is that they do last as long because in our landfill, you know, our garbage gets dumped into these pits every day. They compact that, all that garbage, and then they seal it with 6 inches, you know, of either a clay mixture or, you know, dirt, or in some places concrete, you know,
really?
To seal off smell, critters, any sort of thing. So you're not getting that. Nothing can compost in landfill. Number one, there's no oxygen when you are properly, and in this case, professionally composting in 3 months' time, you have topsoil. These diapers have turned into dirt in 3 months' time. Mm. I mean, doesn't that just blow your mind? Mm-hmm. That the difference in that 300 to 500 years stuck in this, you know, anaerobic cold environment that is producing the methane gas and other harmful gases into our environment, as opposed to 3 months' time and you've got topsoil that can be given right back into the earth, you know, and used in a multitude of purposes.
And can you, do you know, in the industry as a whole, do you know about how many tons a year here in the U.S. we produce in terms of
It's in the billions. I can tell you in the Bay Area alone, mm-hmm. conservatively, 350 million diapers each year go into our Bay Area landfill.
350 million?
Million.
That's staggering.
350,000,000.
Karen Nelson, Earth Baby. It's earth-baby.com.
Earth-baby.com.
Thanks again so much for taking the time to...
Thanks, Alice. It was great to talk with you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Band of Gypsies, Bob Marley and the Wailers, and Anders Osborne. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Sungevity Home Solar Specialists and Incredible Adventures, an eco-friendly outdoor travel company. Go to incadventures.com to learn more. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability.
For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.